You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com. You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com. Welcome to the Chris Spangle Show. My name is Chris Spangle, and it's great to talk with you today. And I love history. It's one of my favorite topics that we don't discuss enough here on the show. And one of the reasons is a sixth grade field trip to Washington, D.C. And we went to George Washington's home, Mount Vernon, and I really started studying the founders really heavily after that and fell in love with it. And I imagine that so did the guest that I have on today is John Berlaw. And he wrote the book, George Washington, Entrepreneur, How Our Founding Fathers' Private Business Pursuits Changed America and the World. He's got the book up there in the video. And John is an award-winning journalist, recipient of the National Press Club's Sandy Hume Memorial Award for Excellence in Political Journalism, and a senior fellow for Finance and Access to Capital at the Great Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's also a columnist for Forbes and Newsmax and has contributed to the Financial Times, Washington Post, Politico, and the Wall Street Journal, Washington Times. So, John, when you decided to, how did you decide to write this book about George Washington? Aren't there enough biographies about George Washington? Why did you decide to write another one about him?
Well, it was actually a trip to Mount Vernon, as you mentioned. When Mount Vernon now, I would urge everyone to go there. There's still a lot of stuff open, even with the lockdown. They have rebuilt some of his enterprises, like the grist mill, flour mill, and the whiskey distillery about a decade ago, showing, you know, some of his enterprises and some of his creativity as an entrepreneur. And I just never knew the side of him, that he could actually build a whiskey distillery, something fun like whiskey, which is made it one of the largest in the country. So there are a lot of books on Washington, but you get, you know, the things like the cherry tree legend, when the real things he did, that how he planted, had a greenhouse built to plant orange trees and lemon trees and all different kinds of trees, as well as building all different kinds of business, is so much more exciting. And he's so much more than the face on the dollar. And I wanted to bring him to life.
Yeah, that was one of the most surprising parts about Mount Vernon, is his industriousness. And when you study the founders, you know, John Adams is brilliant, or Jefferson's writing, or the academic work that a lot of them, and Washington doesn't get lumped in as necessarily an intellectual. It's always said, oh, well, he only read magazines and newspapers, and but he was a great leader. You know, your book really highlights that he was a very intelligent man who had a lot of different interests and skills, in much the vein of the other founders, did he not?
Very much so. And he didn't have the same advantages as them. He, you know, his father died when he was 11. He was a middle child, didn't inherit much at first. So he had to really quit school like around when he was 13 or 14. But he never let his education quit. He was self-educated. And contrary to what other scholars have thought, and this is just coming in from new information about his book inventory, actually people seeing things that he underlined in the books he had, and, you know, purchase orders that he made where he bought books. He read everything. He read quite a bit. He read Shakespeare, political theorists like John Locke. He almost certainly read The Wealth of Nations when Adam Smith, when it came out, laying the foundation of capitalism. In fact, he used the phrase invisible hand, from which Smith had used, you know, in Washington, used it as an inaugural thing. And he would also read about books about agriculture to learn, you know, how to grow better crops, how to grow hemp and wheat rather than tobacco, as well as things like, there were how-to books then. People complimented him on what a good horseman he was. And some were saying, or some said, that's natural ability or experience. And it was both those things. But their shipping orders and receipts show that he actually ordered books about how to be a good horseman, how to do jumps, how to take care of sick horses. So when he wanted to find out something, one of the things he would read, and he read a great deal, even though he didn't have the formal education that Jefferson and some of the other founders had.
So let's talk about the diversity of Mount Vernon in terms of what it produced as a farm, because many of his neighbors were tied to tobacco, but he had a lot of different ventures. What are some of the things that George Washington did at Mount Vernon as a farm?
Well, in the 1760s, after there was sort of a tobacco glut in Great Britain, when the colonists grew tobacco, it was primarily for export. And that meant you had like insurance, the shipping duties, you had to pay the middlemen, plus the British, you know, had duties on that. Whereas he saw he could sell things like wheat for the domestic market. In fact, he took a cue, he learned from everyone, from some of the German immigrants, smaller farmers that were selling wheat. He said, well, why can't we do this on a big farm, a big plantation like Mount Vernon?
Do you mean marijuana when you say weed?
You're saying wheat. But he also grew hemp.
Wheat. Okay. Wheat. All right. There we go. Okay. The tea dropped out there. Okay. I was like,
I'm sorry. He did grow hemp, although there's no evidence he smoked marijuana. In fact, he used hemp from growing. In fact, Mount Vernon is now growing hemp again now that it's legal. But he integrated his enterprises with some of the surplus wheat. He built a grist mill and put the wheat into flour, which he put his own brand name on it, G. Washington, and really has shipped throughout the colonies and to the British West Indies and to Great Britain itself. So he had like an international brand of flour. And then he would go into all sorts of things like, you know, mule breeding. Was one of the first Americans to breed mules, had a mule breeding service, and eventually, after he was president, he built a whiskey distillery, which Mount Vernon has rebuilt. So just so many different kinds of businesses there.
Where did his entrepreneurial spirit come from?
That's a good question. I think part of it was that he had to, it was just survival skills when he was 11. And I think his mother had, you know, was, you know, he didn't always get along with his mother, but she, you know, she sort of made him tough, and, you know, taught him self-reliance. And he started out as a surveyor, surveying land, and his older brother Lawrence, the Fairfax's Fairfax family, who he surveyed with, taught him a lot about just business and looking at, you know, how to do ledgers and things like that. So, he kept very neat ledgers and, you know, invoices of accounts, and was one of the wealthiest men in America when he and a new nation when he died.
Is there any evidence that his farming and that this industriousness impacted his military and political career? I mean, I don't think you can, when you have a man who has three identities, separate those identities. How did those things flow together for George Washington?
In a lot of ways, they did. It has always been a mystery how the Continental Congress, people from different colonies, you know, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, others, in a day when there wasn't mass communication, how he was named general on the first ballot. He did wear a military uniform there. He was, you know, a colonel in the French and Indian War, but his exploits in the French and Indian War weren't that great. But there is a clue when John Adams, in his nominating speech, talks about Washington and his good character, and he also mentions his independent fortune. So I have a theory that I lay out in the book, in George Washington Entrepreneur, that he was, you know, because people knew him from his flour, because it was like an international brand and they recognized the name, that was one of the reasons that he was nominated as general, that his business leadership, and, you know, you have to manage so many expenses there, and there's a great letter I quote in the book where he's ordering beer and cider for the troops and just talking about some of the specific things that they need. And he knew that, you know, he early on said we should get the best map makers and pay them. And he was writing to Congress for an appropriation. And then I think as a surveyor, just knowing the land, the topography, the conditions, you know, and what he was seeing from the map makers making, he knew more about the terrain, had the home field advantage, if you would call it, than the British. So that on things like crossing the Delaware on the Second Battle of Trenton, where they, you know, fought some of the elements of nature, but he knew that, you know, that there was sort of enough for safe passage for his troops, where the British, you know, might have balked at, you know, going through some of this land, that he knew the land, you know, from, you know, being just surveying and real estate explanation, his vocations there. And that played into, you know, knowing the land for, you know, in the military for a battle.
So what you're saying is from the beginning of the country, a successful business brand can be leveraged into a presidential career.
That's basically, yes.
All right. Yeah, the surveying part of his life is often not discussed, but it seems to be, in everything that I've read about Washington, a very formational part of his life and a very significant part of his life. I mean, can you talk a little bit about, I mean, when we think of map making in the 1700s, I mean, it's not like Google Maps with a car driving around everywhere, right? Can you talk a little bit about not only what he would have done as a surveyor, but also how that impacted the rest of his life?
Yes. Well, he was a surveyor as a professional career for about 2 years, from like being like 16 to about 18, started the first survey in like the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia, some of the western part of Virginia, including West Virginia, in those years. He also surveyed what is now the city of Alexandria, sort of like, you know, the streets are still based on some of his original surveys. And he would do that. I mean, as far as battlefields and things like that, examine the boundaries of the land for the rest of his life. His last survey of Mount Vernon was like 5 weeks before he died in 1799. So it's interesting. I talked to some professional surveyors today, and they still use George Washington as a model. And it's kind of funny, you know, he had like a tripod with a compass on it, and you look at surveying equipment today, it's similar, because you have a tripod, but you have a GPS attached to it and a camera instead of the compass. So it's sort of like some things are part of the same profession, and it's still a viable profession. You really don't need to be a surveying technician, and depending on the licensing of the state, you don't really need to go to college for. There are lots of jobs that have gone by the wayside. We still need a lot of surveyors. Angie's List recommends, you know, you'd have a survey done every time you buy a home.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. We are talking to John Berlaw, who is the author of George Washington Entrepreneur, How Our Founding Fathers' Private Business Pursuits Changed America and the World. And, you know, he also helped foster a lot of innovation. Can you talk about how he helped other innovators and inventors in early America? What impact did he have as a steward and a mentor?
Very much so. He was interested in promoting invention, and he welcomed inventors. He said he had a speech when he was president. He welcomed inventors here and, you know, from elsewhere if they wanted to emigrate here. And when people would, you know, after the war, people would come to him, send their inventions or write letters about them to Mount Vernon, and if he would endorse them if he thought that they were viable. But he came across a guy named he could really make a difference in an inventor's life. He came across a guy named James Rumsey in what is now West Virginia, who was building a house for him there, and he had an inn. And Rumsey was trying to build a mechanical boat, And the townspeople thought he was a crackpot, but Washington watched it and wrote this great letter of endorsement. And because of that, Rumsey got a patent. This was before in the 1780s when Washington was a private citizen before the U.S. Patent Office was created. Washington's letter helped Rumsey get patents in Virginia and Maryland. And then Rumsey would change the boat slightly so that it would be a steamboat and, you know, run on steam. And he was able to get it to run like 7 miles. And he and the guy named John Fitch were credited actually in a patent in Washington's administration from being the first inventors of the steamboat 20 years before Robert Fulton commercialized it in about 1808.
That's fascinating. You know, finally, I think we can't end without talking about the very real elephant in the room, and that is slavery and the fact that Mount Vernon, you know, he was a slave owner. It ran on slaves and an oppressive system. I mean, as an author, how do you approach that and how do you deal with that? I was pleased to read, you know, there's 20 pages in the book about this, but can you touch on the moral stain, basically, in my opinion, that he used slavery as a way to be entrepreneurial? Doesn't that diminish George Washington's reputation, in your view?
The fact that he owned slaves diminished his reputation, as well as, you know, the other founding fathers, as well as, you know, that of people in the world at the time. But we have to, I think we have to take into account that this was the world that he knew when he was born in. As we know from the New York Times series, the first slaves came to Virginia in 1619, and George Washington was born 113 years later in 1732. It was a part of his world, and it's important to note that even before 1619, the great African-American historian Henry Louis Gates Jr. points out there were already 500,000 slaves in the North America and the American territory and the American continent by the Spanish and the French. And Henry Louis Gates has also said slavery is as old as civilization itself. But Washington recognized the wrongness of slavery and took steps, what I would say would be to the beginning of the end of it throughout his life. One of the ways was, you mentioned, you know, that he used slaves in his entrepreneurship. There were things he did without enslaved people, including the surveying. So not everything was dependent on slave labor, but in the farming in Mount Vernon, certainly, and they were certainly a big part of it. But when he switched from tobacco to some of the other things, including the grist mill, the whiskey distillery, where the enslaved people were some of the distillers. In fact, today they're honored. That was one of the things that he saw that African Americans were capable of different types of labor, that they were intelligent, and that slavery, the system of slavery, was holding them back. He also saw that from the free blacks who fought in the war, and he would write to people in letters that, you know, he knew would be public, because letters were public in his lifetime, about how he was growing to despise the system. In 1774, in the Fairfax Resolves, which was a precursor to the Declaration of Independence, Washington and George Mason publicly condemned Britain for foisting what they called the cruel system of the slave trade on the colonies. And then Washington would also take steps at cost to him, where he would very rarely break up slave families as far as selling an enslaved person, if that would break up a family. And then when he died, he went in 1799, he went further than any founding father who had slaves, that he freed all of the slaves he owned outright, 124 enslaved people, upon Martha's death. And she freed them early, and also until the 1830s, for some 30 years, provided for their annuities or pensions for their old age, and tried to provide education for the younger freed slaves. So he's not a perfect man, but through this example and others, he led to a more perfect union.
When you start off young and you start off in life and in certain systems, and then as you get older, things change you and you start to realize some of those systems are wrong, and you start to push back on things that you believe for a long time. I mean, what was the catalyst for George Washington? I imagine there has to be something that started to change his view and caused him to go down that path. What do we have any indication what that might have been?
He would talk to a lot of people who were anti-slavery. He had friends among the Quakers, and the Marquis de Lafayette was a part of the French aristocracy, who came over and volunteered and was one of the top commanders. And Washington had at Mount Vernon afterwards, actually was involved in some of the business ventures, like getting some of the donkeys from France. I mean, we know that the Marquis de Lafayette opposed slavery and talked to Washington about that. But again, I think it was the entrepreneurship transforming Mount Vernon sort of to industrial enterprise. He could see that African Americans could do different roles, and that not just farm labor, with teaching, even though it was still they were still enslaved and at the point of the gun, and he just saw that this was I don't know that he ever embraced full equality, but he saw that it was keeping them from reaching their potential as human beings, both from seeing the work that they could do in the different kinds of industries he was entering into, and the free blacks who fought valiantly in the war. In fact, he corresponded with the child prodigy poet Phyllis Wheatley, whose family had freed her from slavery and wrote a very, she wrote a letter praising him. She wrote a poem praising him. And then he wrote a piece, calling her Miss Phyllis and saying how nice it was. So he would just, the examples of African-Americans, both, under his enslavement and under his command in the war, I think changed him, seeing the capabilities of what they could do, as well as talking to people like the Marquis de Lafayette.
Not just from a utilitarian point of view. I mean, was there a relationship that he had with his slaves that may have changed him on a personal level? So, he didn't. I mean, let's just call it what it is. He had a white supremacist view that whites were superior to blacks. I mean, but did he form any friendships through these entrepreneurial ventures that kind of helped him see them as human beings?
I think he felt, a bond. I mean, the one that he freed immediately was, like his personal valet during the war, Billy Lee, and said he can live, he can go where he wants, but he can live in Mount Vernon free of charge with room and board for the rest of his life. So yes, very much so. I think he was seeing of what they could some of the capabilities that he could do. I mean, there was a slave he had called Hercules, who eventually did run away successfully, but he had been cooking dinners, state dinners when Washington was president, and Washington, noted, how impressed he was, saying, he was, he ranked with some of the best French chefs. So I think he was, as far as both the talents and the kindness he saw, the bravery of some of the free black soldiers in the Revolutionary War. So I think that affected him.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. I just want to recommend the book, George Washington, Entrepreneur, How Our Founding Fathers' Private Business Pursuits Changed America and the World by John Berlau. It's spelled B-E-R-L-A-U. You can get it at Amazon. That helps the rankings. And yeah, I mean, final thoughts on George Washington, the man, and you know, where folks can follow you, and one more plug.
I am at Twitter at Jay Berlau. My website for my organization, great organization that is really interested in barriers to entrepreneurship and promoting financial inclusion and the America's heritage of free enterprise, is Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. And I wanted to go back to the inventions a minute, because there was one. Washington would also promote balloonists. He welcomed them into the country and had a big celebration when there were some French balloonists, hot air balloonists, which, you know, had begun in the 1780s, and Washington welcomed there in the 1790s. And he wrote something to a friend about this, saying, well, one day they will be coming from France by, quote, flying through the air. So he was in the days when, you know, horses were the main form of travel, was envisioning commercial passenger flight. And so that it shows that even though he didn't have a formal education, he had a great imagination and really was as creative, as innovative as Franklin and Jefferson in his own way.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me again, George Washington, Entrepreneur. John Berlau, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Thank you for listening to the Chris Spangle Show. We appreciate it, and we will see you again tomorrow.